Thank you for tuning into Legal Systems for Dummies, week number 2. Each of us will be going into more depth of another subject in the legal system between the United States and Nigeria. I myself, Tiffany, will take you into plea bargaining. Annika will cover the Batson challenge, while Chelsea covers sentencing, and Leslie will lead us into jury trials between the United States and Nigeria. Starting with Chelsea and sentencing.
Hello, and welcome to How Will I Be Punished? In this portion of my segment, I'm going to be telling you about the sentencing between the United States and Nigeria. Now, because the United States has 50 different state ways in the way that they sentence criminals, I just focused on the federal level because it's consistent through all 50 states. And it would be a lot easier to compare the United States as a whole versus 50 states versus one country. These are all in criminal cases. Now, once the defendant has been found guilty and there has been a conviction, sentencing takes days, even months, depending on the severity of the case. Now, during this time, the judge isn't just sitting around. He's doing research. They're looking for sources on how to sentence that person. They're looking for minimum and maximum sentence options that Congress has made. These are federal-state mandatory sentencing. The judge imposes identical sentences for the convicts of the same crime. The theory behind this is that it would reflect legislator and Congress concerns for public and their concerns expressed. This would also show that they are not being lenient or inconsistent in a criminal sentencing, showing the public that they actually care and are listening to their concerns. After the judge has implemented any mandatory sentencing that they may have had to do, then they go ahead and go to the sentencing guidelines. These tend to just be recommendation punishments. They take into account the crime, factors, consideration, but we'll come back to that in a little bit. First, I wanted to describe this table for you a little bit. So there's rows and there's columns. On the rows, it has different offense levels. It describes the characteristics of the crime, the amount of money that was stolen, the amount of drugs that could have been stolen or sold. And then there's columns, and the columns purely has to do with the defendant. And all it does is state the criminal history. And then these people are ranked on this table, and that gives you a general idea of how to sentence someone. Going back to these offense levels, they're categorized into zones. So there's Zone A, Zone B, Zone C, Zone D, and then there's the criminal history points across the top for the defendant. There are 43 offense levels in the guidelines. The higher the level, the more severe the crime is considered to be, and generally the longer the prison sentence suggested by the guidelines is. So, for example, the guidelines suggest that someone convicted of a level 1 offense should receive prison sentence between 0 and 6 months, but a criminal convicted of a level 43 offense would receive a sentence of life in prison. Now, on top of the base offense levels, every type of offense carries a certain number of offense characteristics. These can raise or lower based on the offense level and can affect their sentences. A few examples of those would be like a house burglary or a theft offense. That level begins at about 17 and increases based upon the amount of property stolen. If the burglary or theft led to the loss of over $2,500 of property, an additional level is added. If the loss was more than $80,000, 5 levels are added. Robbery has a base offense of 20, but if a gun was displayed in the robbery, there's an increase of 5. This brings the total level to 25, but if the firearm was fired during the robbery, There is an increase of 7 levels. There's so many different factors. You can't just look at a crime. In this one particular instance, so many things could have contributed to less or more points added. It also depends on if the defendant has committed the same crime before, if they've got a history of committing crimes, if there was any other offenders, the nature of the crime itself, and if the defendant has shown regret or remorse over what they did. There's different adjustments that are factors that may apply to an offense that can either raise or lower the offense level. These are usually broken down as victim-related adjustment. Really, just what the offender's role was in the offense. So an example is if, like, someone barely participated in a crime, like being a getaway driver, the offense level would decrease by 4. If the offender knew the victim was vulnerable because of a mental condition, the offense is increased by 2. If the criminal just obstructed justice, the offense level is raised by 2. There is also the option of being convicted for several different federal crimes. And in the sentencing guidelines, the instructions show how the judge can reach a combined offense level. The guidelines have incremental punishment for major additional criminal behavior. The more serious the federal offenses start at the starting point, the other federal counts will determine whether to and how much to move forward the offense level. A judge can also determine the offense level under sentencing guidelines if they feel the defendant has accepted responsibility. The federal judge can decrease the offense level by 2 if they feel like they should. If you've accepted responsibility, they have the discretion to decide whether the deduction should be granted. Judges can consider whether the defendant has admitted to the crime, paid restitution before a guilty verdict was issued, or pled guilty. All of these are contributing factors. Now, I'd like to take a moment to talk about these columns. The criminal history, or the criminal history points, as they're called on the table. So, the principle behind the federal sentencing guidelines is that repeat offenders should be given longer prison sentences than people convicted of fewer prior criminal acts. To achieve the points, they're awarded for every prior conviction. And the number of points awarded can get a little complicated, but I found some examples. So 1 point is given for each prior conviction that resulted in a sentence of less than 60 days. 2 points are given for each prior conviction that resulted in a sentence between 60 days and 13 months. 3 points are given for each prior conviction that resulted in a sentence greater than 13 months. Now, all the points are added up, and the total is used to determine the criminal history category of the convicted person. The guidelines have 6 different criminal history categories. Now, this all seems a little complicated when you're just talking about it, but using the sentencing table is pretty easy and pretty simple. The criminal history categories are listed on the top, and the offense levels are listed on the left. The sentence that should be imposed is listed where the two intersects on the table. Pretty simple. It's like checking a graph. An example would be someone with a criminal history of 1 convicted a criminal offense of a level 8. When you line that up on the table, they should be sentenced to between 0 and 6 months in prison. However, if someone convicted of that same level 8 offense has a criminal history of 5, they should be sentenced between 15 and 21 months in prison. It shows that people with history need to serve more time to learn the lesson a little bit more. Now, not to discourage you for any of you future criminals out there, because the judge can deviate. The federal sentencing guidelines allows judges to deviate from the suggested sentence in particular cases. potentially yours, if that's what you're planning on doing. The sentencing table listed sentences in four different zones, A, B, C, and D. People who fall into zone A can be given probation without having to serve any time in jail or prison. People who fall into zone B must serve at least 1 month in prison, but are eligible to serve the remainder of their sentence in alternative confines, such as like a home detention. People who fall in zone C must serve at least half of their total sentence in prison, but can serve the other half in alternative confinements. If that wasn't enough, judges also have the leeway to impose greater or lesser prison sentences if the circumstance warrant deviating from the guidelines in such ways. For instance, someone who assists in the prosecution of another defendant might receive a lesser sentence than that suggested by the sentencing table. But someone who used a deadly weapon while committing the crime might receive a greater sentence than that suggested by the sentencing guidelines. That's just a few of the reasons, but there are many other that a judge might deviate from the guidelines in any particular case. Now, it's important to understand that the use of the federal sentencing guidelines is not mandatory. As the United States Supreme Court ruled it in United States v. Booker, that the guidelines violate the Sixth Amendment right to trial by jury. However, the federal sentencing guidelines are still used, and judges who use them to impose sentences on those convicted of federal crimes are presumed to have ruled reasonably, which makes it more difficult for the sentence to get overturned on appeal. Using the sentencing guidelines is a very great way to sentence someone who has a prior history, or depending on the offense that they've committed. It's kind of hard to sentence someone just by the crime when you don't know anything about this person. You're more likely to sentence them more anyways if they have a previous history. This kind of gives the judge an example of how much they should sentence them more if they're a repeat offender. Okay, are you ready to switch gears? So now we're going to move away from the sentencing guidelines and we're going to talk about capital punishment. Yes, the death penalty. Death penalty is still lethal injection is the most common way, and it's considered the most humane way. Now, federally, the death penalty is not against the Constitution, but state by state it varies. There's 30 states with the death penalty and 20 without. They've abolished it or overturned it. Now, there's a ton of information out there on the death penalty, but it's only for conviction of capital punishments. They have to be like a violent homicide, murder, treason, murder of a government official, large-scale drug enterprises, genocide, killing and kidnapping a congressman, and it has to be jury convicted. Now, no one under the age of 18 is sentenced to death, but there is a state-by-state difference. Again, we're just going to focus on federally. Now, all states have different views on what the sentencing for the death penalty should be. Almost all of them include murder and aggravated murder and first degree murder and felony murder, and the list goes on and on and on and on. Now, the death penalty in the United States is almost exclusively just for the crime of murder, as we've already kind of touched on. Although state and federal statutes contain various capital crimes other than those involving the death of the victim, there really has only been two people of non-murder offensive that have been sentenced to the death penalty. Since those non-murder offenses, when the U.S. Supreme Court addressed the issue in 2008, no one had been executed for such a crime since the death penalty was reinstated in 1976. In 1977, the U.S. Supreme Court held that the death penalty for rape of an adult was an excessive punishment and hence was unconstitutional under the Eighth Amendment. The court looked at the relatively few states that allowed the death penalty for rape and the few death sentences that had been handed down, and they decided to just let those go. Some states passed new laws allowing the death penalty for rape of a child. For example, in 2007, the Louisiana Supreme Court upheld the death penalty for a guy for the rape. However, some states passed new laws allowing the death penalty for the rape of a child. Like in 2007, the Louisiana Supreme Court upheld the death sentence for a guy for raping his stepdaughter. And actually, if you have some spare time, you can go to deathpenaltyinfo.org and you can look up a bunch of information about the death penalty. These include the death sentences of 2012, 13, 14, and goes all the way up to the present year. You can see who's about to be executed and you can see the database. It even breaks it down by state, race, gender. It breaks it down completely for you. Even down by offense. The last bit I'm going to talk about is the three strikes statute provided for mandatory life imprisonment of a convicted felon. So this kind of goes along with the lines of three strikes you're out in baseball, if you want to think of it that way, because I do. Several different factors has to go in there. Like, the criminal has to have been convicted in federal court of a serious violent felony and has had two or more previous convictions in a federal or state court, at least one of which has also been a serious violent felony. The other offense may also be a serious drug offense. So, what exactly is a serious violent felony? This would be murder, manslaughter, sex offenses, kidnapping, robbery, and any offense really punishable by 10 years or more, which also has to include an element of the use of force or involves a significant risk of force. The primary focus of these laws is the containment of repeat offenses by a small number of criminals. Now, there has been a lot of consideration for the variety and how these laws are set up, and either how a strike is defined or how many strikes are required. Now, under this law, a person who's convicted of three felonies is given a mandatory 25 to life sentence. Unlike the federal state laws, the three strikes law vary quite a bit from state to state. However, under all the federal and state three strikes law, if someone is convicted of a crime three times, there is no discretion from a judge in sentencing these repeat offenders. This means that in all cases, the offender must go to jail for 25 years to life if convicted of three felonies, no matter the seriousness of the crime. Now, under the statute, a serious violent felony, as we've already talked about, includes murder, manslaughter, sex offenses, kidnapping, robbery, any offense punishable by 10 years or more in prison. The statute also highlights certain non-qualifying felonies, like unarmed robbery offenses and arsons that pose no threat to human life. All those, they can't be included in the serious violent felonies. The purpose of this three strikes law is to put criminals out of society to keep them from committing future crimes. The three strikes law keeps offenders in prison for at least 25 years after their third convictions. If criminals choose to continue to break the law, they will then have to pay for their crimes. Criminals will not get a fourth chance to break the law. The three strikes law is a great way to ensure justice and stop criminals from committing more crimes. And it is seen as a great way that it puts chronic offenders behind bars, and then it lowers the crime rates and provides punishment that's well-deserved. It could also deter offenders who have been convicted of two or more felonies from committing a crime a third time. Criminals know the punishment before they decide to do the crime. The hope is that this will discourage criminals from committing any major crimes. It's giving them an extra chance. They know that this is their last chance. Now, there's many more ways that there is sentencing in the United States, and I just decided to talk about just a few of them because there are so many. Now, we're going to start talking about Nigeria and what they do to sentence criminals and what exactly their process is. What do they do? How is it so different from the United States? Now, it's amazing that we chose this time to compare the United States to Nigeria, because the Chief Justice in Nigeria just launched sentencing guidelines in March of 2018, which is huge. It is said to ensure uniformity in sentencing and fines imposed by certain offenses. Now, they're still in the process of review, and they're still trying to bring it to the final stage. So there's only a little bit of information covering these sentencing guidelines so far. And what they have so far is that there's 7 areas, kind of like our different zones. And these are offenses against the state, offenses against the person, against public order, against morality, against poverty, homicide offenses, and corruption-related offenses. They decided to put these into guidelines because there wasn't a whole lot of ground rules when it came to sentencing a criminal. In Nigeria, those who have been previously convicted in criminal cases usually get harsher sentences or punishments than first offenders. But here's where it gets a little bit different. The conviction goes with sentencing to some form of punishment or sanction concluded by the trial court. Such sanctions or punishments could take any combination or just one of these forms, such as like prison, fine, canning, lashing, corporal or capital punishment, banishment, forfeiture, and the list goes on and on. Here's where it gets a little bit different. When a criminal has served their time of their sentence or their punishment, they then become free and clean of any blame that led to their trial or their conviction. But sometimes in the more serious cases, the convict is not acceptable as having been cleaned by society after they have served their punishment or sentences. In Nigeria, the issue of sentencing is a little less complex than it is in the United States. This is mostly because of the type of federalism practiced in Nigeria, and there's no jury in the judicial system. So whereas in the United States, everyone has a Sixth Amendment right to a jury trial, the judge determines the sentence based on the considerations of several factors on a standard of either preponderance of the evidence or guilty beyond a reasonable doubt. The only exception is where the death penalty, it has to be imposed by a jury. In Nigeria, because of the absence of juries, the judge is the only one that determines both guilt and the sentence in both civil and criminal cases. Because Nigeria has yet to put forth their federal sentencing guidelines, we're going to look at the closest thing to federal sentencing guidelines in Nigeria. Because laws are made in Nigeria just like they are made in the U.S., federal and state legislators make a law, it is passed prohibiting certain conduct, then the state law will contain within itself the prescribed punishment for that violation. A good example of this would be the law prohibiting stealing in Nigeria. Now, obviously, there are several statutes that go underneath this as well, but this describes the offense of stealing in detail, stating what is capable of being stolen and the different ingredients of the offense of stealing. And it states, any person who steals anything capable of being stolen is guilty of a felony and is liable for no other punishment, is provided to imprisonment for 3 years. Mostly all the rules are like that. The laws in Nigeria are very specific on punishment, and all a judge really has to do is determine the guilt and then look to the statutes for that amount of punishment. It's kind of like our mandatory sentencing guidelines here. Now, there are some laws that allow for judges to use discretion on sentencing, and when that happens, specific ranges are provided, and they're short so that there is no real issue of wide disparity throughout the sentencing from case to case. But also, there is no difference between case to case. Now, while in the United States, we're allowed to determine sentences based on certain factors, based on the criminal's past behavior, in Nigeria, it's totally illegal. Previous character evidence is not admissible in trial, even if the defendants give evidence of good character, or attacks the character of the prosecution, or where bad character is an essential element of the offense charge. A Nigerian judge then imposes a sentence not based on a person's past conduct, but as a punishment for the present crime, in which case he only has to look at the statute for creating. He takes no outside factors into consideration. All of these factors are easy to see in the federal sentencing guidelines that are being put forth, as they are more straightforward and a little bit more specific than the USA, and they don't really have as many criticisms. So it'll be a little bit interesting to see how they incorporate their current sentencing to their guidelines. What exactly are they going to do when they don't really allow for a whole lot of discretion? Will that be changed in the new sentencing guidelines? I'm excited to see how they turn out and what exactly they plan on doing. If they plan on mirroring it off the United States sentencing guidelines, or maybe they're just doing it for theirs. We'll have to wait and see for that one. Now, once an accused person is convicted, the judge must pass a sentence on him, and the sentence passed would be one that's prescribed for the offense under the statute creating that offense. The different sentences, as I stated before, are death penalty, imprisonment, fine, canning, lashing, forfeiture, deportation, probation, suspended sentence, community work, plea bargaining, and a few other short ones. Under Nigerian criminal law, various offenses are punishable by death across the Federation, including things like murder, treason, armed robbery, arson, invasion of Nigeria. More recently, they just added kidnapping as being added to the list. Some have even added oil theft and crude oil bunkering. Now, because Nigeria also has Shahara-based criminal law, some of northern Nigeria has also broadened the number of capital offenses to include like adultery, sodomy, lesbianism, and rape, where death sentence is prescribed by the law, same and mandatory, and trial judge has very little discretion to exercise as far as they're concerned. After an accused has been found guilty of that capital offense, the only sentence open to the court to impose is one of death. Now I'd like to touch on a few of the different things they do for execution in Nigeria. Like hanging. Hanging can only be done under Sharia law. Under the Federal Robbery and Firearms Act. Now it's only available in the federal capital territory where this hanging death sentence can be carried out, if it's been decided by their governor. Even though it has been declared unconstitutional, unless it's been overruled by the Lagos state, they can still hang someone as capital punishment. Stoning is a Sharia law punishment that is only reserved for Muslims. And the punishment applies very broadly for adultery, rape, incest, only if the offender is married. And homosexuality. Requirements for demonstrating these offenses are very demanding if they're enforced. But there's also crucifixion as allowed for punishment under Sharia law. These are mainly for armed robbery, which result in a debt when property is actually taken. A few of these crimes is strictly aimed at disgracing the offender, like lashing or flogging. It applies mostly to just Muslims. What's strange about this is that it's always executed in an enclosed place and the public is always permitted to watch. But what do you have to do to get a lashing? Yeah, it can only happen if the offender commits adultery, drinking, injuries, falsehood. And they've made it to where the lashing has to be a little bit more moderate. Like, the one holding the whip has to use their third, fourth, or fifth fingers. And they cannot use their thumb. They're not even allowed to raise their hand over their shoulder.
Sit back while Leslie takes us through the jury trial system.
Could you tell me your name, please?
Nancy Maria Ambriz.
So now that you know more about Nigeria and the U.S. legal system, we're going to talk about Nigeria's and the U.S. jury trial. First, do you know what is a jury trial?
No.
A jury trial is like a group of between 6 or 12 people that are in a criminal case. Instead of just having a judge decide your sentence for a criminal case, you have a jury, which is a 6 to 12 group of people, decide your case. Like, help give you the sentence and help the judge decide your sentence.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Do you know how people are chosen for a jury trial?
I think it's like random. I don't know if it's random or not. But it comes from like different type of race, like age and background. I don't know, maybe.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so basically there's like a whole process to get people on a jury. So I don't know if you know, but like Wendy had to be on jury duty, remember?
Uh-huh.
Or she had to go to court, yeah. So like people here usually in the US are chosen that way. The government chooses people. And then not just like 6 to 12 people, but like a whole bunch of people. And then there's like different cases they could be on. And then they start choosing people who they think are going to be helpful for in the case. So they have like questions and they start kicking people off of that case and find them a new case to be on. So that's how people get chosen to be on a jury, specifically for a criminal case. Does the U.S. have a jury trial?
Yes.
Do you think Nigeria has jury trials too?
Yes.
Okay, you're right and wrong, because only one place in Nigeria has jury trials, which is Lagos. But other than that, the rest of Nigeria doesn't.
Oh.
It's just one place that has it.
That's interesting.
Mm-hmm. So, basically right now, more people want Nigeria to bring jury trials to criminal cases because a lot of people feel like there's injustice into their cases and feel like the judge doesn't give them a fair trial or a fair sentence in general for most cases.
Okay.
So more people in Nigeria want a jury trial. Now that you know more about jury trials in Nigeria and the U.S., do you feel that Nigeria should also have jury trials and why?
I think yes. Because it gives them, like, a voice, like, of what they think of, like, who should have, like, the right to, if they're guilty or not. Like, if they're having, like, the same, like, laws and amendments like us, like, they should have the right as well to have, like, their voice and what they think of that as well.
And now, Tiffany, myself, will cover plea bargaining. Take a seat.
Thanks for tuning back in to Legal Systems for Dummies. This week, I will be covering plea bargains. I did a little bit of research in the U.S. as I knew quite a bit about it already from class. I knew that a lot of people take plea bargains versus going to trial. And a lot of people plead guilty to something that they might not have done just to save money or save time, or the fact that they're scared or it could ruin, you know, certain relationships or their, I guess, perception of themselves. So I dug a little deeper into it to see if Nigeria had similar plea bargains and if they were taken just as much as in the U.S. And from what I can find, the system looks like, again, a lot similar to the U.S. So first I started with Chase, who, just to remind you, was my 6-year-old son, just to see. I knew he wasn't going to know anything in these terms, but I figured just to see what he would say about plea bargains and what he thinks. So here is Chase.
Hi, Chase.
Hi.
Are you ready for some more questions from Mom?
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay, remember last time? Do you remember what we talked about last time?
Yeah.
What did we talk about?
I talked about your...
Yep. Well, class, my school homework, right? So it was judges, remember? Do you remember what a judge is?
No.
Remember, they make the decision if somebody was in trouble and if they did the trouble. And then they tell them if they have to go to jail or not. Remember?
Yeah.
Yeah, you remember? Okay, Mommy wants to ask you a question this time. So when somebody is naughty and they get in trouble and they got to go to court for that trouble, they can get, I guess they can go to court and they can do what's called a plea bargain, which it's if you want to be honest and say that you did the trouble. So say you were naughty and you broke a window of somebody's house and then with your balls outside. And then you had to go to court. And if you want to say that you did it, you won't get in as much trouble if you lie about it and you say that you didn't do it. Or if so, you would tell them that you did it and then you wouldn't get in as much trouble. Otherwise, if you didn't do it, say Brody next door did it, you could go to court and say, I didn't do it, and you want to go see the judge and tell the judge, I didn't do it, my neighbor did it. Okay, so with that being said, do you think it's a good idea that we have the option of saying that you did it when you did it?
No.
No? You don't think so? You think everybody should go to court and say that they didn't do it?
Half of no and half of yes.
So yes and no? You think that if people did it, they should just say that they did it so that way they don't have to get in trouble so much?
Yeah.
Yeah. Do you think that all the people that get in trouble admit that they did it and take a plea bargain, or do you think that they fight it?
They just do it.
They fight it?
Yeah.
Yeah, you don't think all of them admit it? No. Do you think a lot of them admit it or just some? Just some. Yeah. Do you think that, remember last time we talked about Africa and Nigeria?
Yeah.
Remember? Do you think that in Africa that they have a system like that, that somebody can just admit that they did it and not get in as much trouble?
Yeah.
Yeah, you think so?
Yep.
Do you think it's a good idea to have that?
Yeah.
So that way judges aren't overworked?
Yeah.
Yeah. All right, dude. Thanks for your interview again.
As it sits, it looks like the plea bargain system in Nigeria is super similar to the U.S. They see that there are some bad things with it, such as taking it just to save money, stuff like that, and then to save the caseloads. One of the things that I did find out is that in Nigeria, they try to push towards mediation and the process of mediation versus a plea bargain. And then they also think that they're trying to, I guess, get into system a law about the rules and procedures of a plea bargain. Because right now, as it sits, it's basically on the law practitioners' say-so. So they pretty much get to decide, you know, the prosecutor gets to decide what they want to plea bargain, you know, what they want to offer, what they don't want to offer, and which that in itself, you know, sometimes can be good, but at the same time can be bad because, you know, everybody's biased. So it's a little difficult to trust that the prosecution is being, I guess, fair. So that's one of the things they talk about, is that they want to try to move towards more of a mediation versus the plea bargain, or at least get rules and procedures and like the punishments set out in a law that have to be followed by everybody. One of the things also that they talked about is that in the U.S. plea bargains are good and bad. You know, they're good, they save time, they save money, they, you know, save everybody's, you know, basically time to, rather than going to trial. However, they're bad because, one, some people could be uneducated about it and just want to take the plea bargain rather than continuing to go to court. Two, it, you know, they don't have the financial resources to go to trial. There's multiple other things that could go into that. So with that being said, it's definitely up in the air whether it's good or bad, but it is definitely incorporated throughout pretty much all of the countries from what I see, not just the U.S. and Nigeria. Some of the states, I don't know if it's called a state in Nigeria, but for instance, Lagos, they incorporate plea bargains as well, which they seem to be more, from what the research I'm finding, more restrictive of stuff in the court systems, and they as well do offer plea bargains. I know that at one point we in the U.S. tried to abolish plea bargaining, however, with the fact that we have so many cases, it just isn't possible. It's not possible to get rid of it because then our cases would be ginormous. We would have to have millions and millions more working and judges, and we just don't have enough time. We don't have enough time as it is when 90% of our cases end in plea bargain, let alone having those all go to trial. So with that being said, I did interview my mom again, and just to see what she knew about the plea bargain system. Okay, we are ready. Hi, Mom.
Hi.
So, last time I interviewed you, I think I asked you about judges in Nigeria and how many you thought they had in the Supreme Court and stuff. This time, yeah, I get to talk to you about plea bargains.
Oh, goodness.
Do you know what a plea bargain is?
Yes.
So, obviously, we have them in the U.S., and
some are good, some are bad.
Yes. So with the plea bargains in the U.S., out of how much percent of cases do you think that go through the court system end up taking a plea bargain versus going to trial?
What percentage?
Yeah.
I'd probably say 75 to 80.
Close. Like, it's about 90%.
I was gonna say that.
Yeah, it's close to it. Do you think that everybody that takes a plea bargain actually did the crime?
No.
Why do you think that somebody would take a plea bargain if they didn't do the crime versus going to trial?
can't afford an attorney to keep to go to trial and pay for that long of a court trial?
That's definitely one of the reasons. In Nigeria, you know, we went through with the judges in courts. Do you think that they offer plea bargains over there?
I'm gonna take a wild guess and say no.
They do offer plea bargains, and they're actually super similar to ours. However, I can't find anything like to figure out how many people actually take plea bargains versus going to trial, but they do offer them over there also. So it's like they're pretty much the same law system as we are. Isn't that insane?
Cool.
It seems like the older generation, I guess, so my mom, I guess my age, obviously not first graders, know more about plea bargains. They don't know the specifics, but they at least have a general idea about plea bargains, which leads to, I interviewed Alex, my boyfriend, again, who has, again, had some involvement in the criminal system, himself has taken plea bargains. And I guess this is what he knew about the plea bargain system. All right, so last time I talked to you about judges, do you remember talking about judges?
Yeah.
This time it's still in the court system. It's about plea bargains. Do you know what a plea bargain is?
Kind of.
What do you think a plea bargain is?
Make a deal instead of taking it to trial or fighting whatever you got charged with.
Okay, that's pretty much what it is. Basically, if somebody gets charged with something, they can plead guilty to it so they get a lesser sentence versus taking it to trial. Do you think plea bargains are good or bad?
Sometimes they can be good.
Why do you think that?
Plea bargain's good enough, and you don't have to hire a lawyer.
So, in your eyes, it's good, like, cost-effective to have a plea bargain sometimes?
Yeah.
Do you think that everybody that takes a plea bargain is actually guilty of the crime that they are being accused of?
No.
Why do you think somebody would take a plea bargain, but they didn't do the crime? Why would they plead guilty to something they didn't do?
They might not have money for a lawyer.
That's pretty much one of the reasons that a lot of people do. A lot of people take plea bargains that aren't actually guilty of the crime, just to save time and to save money. Okay, what percentage of cases do you think that the court system gets take a plea bargain versus goes to trial?
Probably 50-50.
Actually, it's 90% of cases in the United States take a plea bargain versus going to trial. Do you think that Nigeria has plea bargains?
Yes.
Do you think they are similar to ours, or?
I guess so.
Do you think that knowing our percentage of cases that go to plea bargain versus trial, what do you think the percentage is in Nigeria?
About the same.
It is. I didn't find an exact percentage for Nigeria, but it's very similar to the U.S. Do you think that what ways could we improve the plea bargain system, do you think?
Improve the plea bargain?
Mm-hmm. Because if people are pleading guilty to crimes that they didn't do, it doesn't sound like it's very effective.
I have no idea.
So in conclusion, it looks like a little bit more knowledge of the plea bargain system exists versus, for instance, judges that I did last week. With that being said, we all talked about the pros and cons of plea bargaining, and hopefully we can start to diminish those cons some way, somehow, down versus and have more pros of the situation. And because, like I said earlier, it's just not feasible to get rid of plea bargaining altogether. So maybe a law in place of what can, you know, the procedures, punishments, stuff like that, might do some good, but who knows at this point. And then with Nigeria, they, you know, they're incorporating a couple different things. So it's going to be interesting to see which way they start heading with plea bargains. And then it's weird to think, I guess, I don't know if weird is the correct word, but it's weird that they are so much like us. And before I started doing this research, I guess I didn't know a lot about Nigeria, and I kind of just assumed that, you know, one, there wasn't a lot of crime there, and two, why, you know, if there's not a lot of crime, why do they need such a big court system and, you know, plea bargains? But it looks like that, you know, Nigeria does have quite the caseload, and they themselves struggle with caseloads, which is why there are plea bargains incorporated over there. So it's kind of cool to keep finding out that they are very similar to the U.S. when it comes to the legal systems.
Hi, my name is Annika Patterson, and this is Legal Systems for Dummies, Bets and Challenge Edition. If you tuned in last week, I covered the common law and other law practices used in the United States and Nigeria. This week, I will be uncovering the truths about racial discrimination and the criminal justice systems of the United States through the Batson Challenge and Nigeria. Tune in with me on this week's episode, and let's see what the average person thinks about this controversial discussion. To get started, I asked individuals what they thought about racial bias existing in the criminal justice system, followed by asking if they've heard about the Batson Challenge. Do you think that a prejudice or racial bias exists in the United States criminal justice system?
Yes, I think in certain cases it definitely does exist.
And have you ever heard of the Batson Challenge?
I have not.
Do you think that a prejudice or racial bias exists in the United States criminal justice system?
Yeah, I really do think so. Just because, like, all, like, the police stuff, too, and then, like, right. I don't know, I think some people still just have racial, like, biases, even though it's not right, but...
Right. Have you ever heard of the Batson Challenge in regards to jury selection?
No.
Do you think that a prejudice or racial bias exists in the United States criminal justice system?
Yes, I do.
Any reasons why?
Because stats show that people of color or from not white descent are not only, like, suspected for crime, but also have, like, longer sentencing or, like, longer waits than, like, people who are white.
Okay. So have you ever heard of a Batson Challenge in terms of the court system?
No.
Do you think that a racial bias exists in the United States legal system?
You know what? I'm going to say no. And I'm going to tell you why.
Okay.
Because I think that racism certainly exists in America, but it exists everywhere. And in a system where you're putting power into people who have authority, like police or the criminal justice system, like lawyers or anything, I don't think race plays a role. I think that there are certainly racist people, but I don't think it plays a role in any part of our system. And the fact that crime rates are higher in some areas, so police are going to be attracted to those areas, black or white.
Okay. Have you ever heard of the Batson Challenge in the legal system?
I have not.
Have not. What is a Batson Challenge exactly? Let's set the record straight. In the United States, during the process of preparing for a criminal trial, prosecutors and defense attorneys get to choose a jury for the case if the case is going to end up going to a jury trial. During their selection process for choosing a jury, prosecutors and defense attorneys are allowed to make strikes or peremptory challenges against a potential juror if the side sees a challenge for cause. In other words, they don't see the juror as impartial. Each side is allowed a certain number of challenges in a jury selection process. The Batson challenge was introduced in the court system following the Supreme Court case Batson v. Kentucky, a case in which a black man was being charged with second-degree burglary and receipt of stolen goods. The prosecutor in the case against this man used all of his strikes against the four black potential juries during the jury selection process. The man was found guilty by an all-white jury on both charges. After appealing his case to the Supreme Court declared that a prosecutor's use of the peremptory challenge is impermissible if it is used to strike a juror on the basis of one's gender or race. The Supreme Court declared that prosecutors had to then give a valid reason for striking that juror and prove that it wasn't racially driven before a judge. This gave birth to the Batson challenge in criminal trials, all in hopes to create positive change in the jury selection process, to ensure that racial discrimination is left out of the equation, and to hopefully give defendants the opportunity to be represented fairly in a jury trial. After relaying that information to those same individuals on the Batson Challenge, I asked them if they thought this was a good thing for our system to have included in the jury selection process. Now that I kind of gave you important background about the Batson Challenge and why that could be seen as protection against racial discrimination, what are your opinions? What do you think about the Batson Challenge?
I think the Batson Challenge is useful because I do think there are some prosecutors that could be filing based on racial background.
What are your thoughts about the Batson Challenge?
Well, I think it's good because then you can make sure that, like, the prosecutor or whatever doesn't just, like, pick it and try to, like, opinionate the jury or whatever. Mm-hmm. So, like, it gives, like, both sides a chance to, like, to make sure that it's, like, actually a fair, like...
Trial,
yeah.
Right.
What do you think about the Batson Challenge after I've filled you in?
I think that it has to do with racial bias and the jury and who decides, like, who's guilty and who's not. And pretty much, like, when you're going through something like this, you have to, like, make sure that somebody's not, like, racially biased when making a decision on, like, somebody's sentencing.
There is an extended history of racism existing in the United States of America, a country that promises freedom and equality to all. Racial discrimination could and does exist in this country's legal system, and it is shown as in the facts. Black men and women are incarcerated at more than 5 times the rate of white men and women. With the clear racial bias against certain demographics in the criminal justice system, the people I asked felt that Batson is necessary, or something like it needs to exist, despite its flaws, because it is important to hold prosecutors accountable, especially in the Batson versus Kentucky case, where freedom is at stake. Representation on a jury was crucial for a fair trial. Next, I was curious to see if people could see a racial bias possibly existing in the criminal justice system in Nigeria, a country's population that is predominantly of African descent. Could you see something along the lines of racial bias or racial discrimination existing in the legal system of a country like Nigeria?
I think it's kind of hard to see the racial side of it, but I do definitely think there's discrimination against probably women and men, the difference there.
Okay. Interesting. So Batson historically in the United States, is supposed to protect against gender and race, right? So do you think that something like Batson then could exist in Nigeria?
Against gender?
Possibly. Do you think that could exist there?
I think it could exist. Do I think it exists? No, not necessarily. Okay. I think American standards are
different compared to the Nigerian.
Do you think that a possible racial bias could exist in a country like Nigeria's legal system?
Yeah, I don't know if more like racial, but I feel like different like groups there, like where you come from, could like be part of like more like the racial thing like that we have here.
Right. So it's
like kind of like the whatever it's called.
Ethnicity, maybe?
Yeah, okay. Like where they're from, like within like the country, or like if they're poor or rich.
Right. Just so class, like, maybe too.
Yeah.
Okay, that's actually a pretty good answer. Do you think that something like Batson could exist in Nigeria? So in an instance where, you know, challenges are made by either side where they can strike a juror, do you think that there's protections like Batson in Nigeria?
Like right now, like there already is?
No, I'm just asking what like you're saying. Do you think there is? Not if like there should be, but do you think that exists there?
I probably feel like it doesn't exist much there because okay. I feel like just like their whole like law system and stuff isn't as like developed as ours.
Something to compare the United States to, could you see a racial bias existing in a country like, let's say, Nigeria?
Possibly, yeah. I mean, I think that anywhere there could be like racial bias because like it's really hard and no matter where you're at to avoid like stereotypes, and I think that any type of judgment like roots from stereotypes, so I feel like no matter where you're at, like it may not be to like a like as great of an extent that the U.S. has, but I feel like no matter where you're at, there's gonna be.
Why would that be?
Because of stereotypes, like that's where it roots from, and I think that's hard to avoid. Like as a human being, like nobody's perfect. I feel like there's judgment all around, but like even if people don't mean
so
to.
In the legal system, you think that could exist there too?
Yeah.
Okay. And then, do you think maybe to avoid issues in legal trials in Nigeria, do you think that they may have a protection like the Batson Challenge for jury selection, or do you think that could exist there? What do you think?
I mean, I think it could exist.
Okay, so do you think that a racial bias could exist in a country like Nigeria?
No. I think that racism is everywhere, and that apart from the system, as it applies similar to America, that there's racism, but it doesn't play a part or role
in their legal system.
In their legal system.
Okay.
And then, so with that, you would probably say no to something like a protection like Batson existing in their legal system for their courts.
Can they have...
Do you think... It's just a guess. Do you think that they have something like Batson to protect?
I would say they don't.
Okay. Through my research, I discovered that nothing like a Batson challenge exists in Nigeria to protect against the ethnic, gender, or racial discrimination that occurs in the criminal justice system. In fact, I found that only one city in Nigeria even uses juries in criminal trials. In 1861, the city of Lagos was ceded to the British Crown. And in 1863, that city was home to the first and only Supreme Court in Nigeria, which their jurisdiction had only extended to certain parts of southern Nigeria. Lagos was and is a very ethnically diverse city. It consists of people from the Yoruba tribe, which is the dominant tribe of southern Nigeria. And historically, many liberated slaves from Brazil and Sierra Leone lived in Lagos due to the also major presence of European businessmen who had brought the slaves to Nigeria when it was taken over by the British Crown. The liberated slaves from Sierra Leone, unlike the Brazilians, were able to speak English and were British subjects. Many of the freed Brazilian slaves living in Nigeria had immigrated back to their motherland. One third of Lagos's population was comprised of these liberated slaves. Because of this, bad relations existed in Nigeria between the Europeans and the educated Africans. After a decade of English presence in the Lagos city, common law was introduced as the main legal system in 1874. Although common law systems allow for juries in criminal trials, jury trials had existed before that was introduced to Lagos in 1864. Like the United States, there was ethnic tensions in the criminal justice system in Nigeria, and often there was discrimination of race and gender on juries. Predominantly, non-Africans were on the juries during criminal trials, as there were specifications that stated you needed to be property-owning, English-speaking citizens to get jury duty. According to a law journal written by Emmett Middle Beeler, many British officers in Lagos believed that the native African men of Lagos were not even fit to serve on juries that involved cases of white men. there was a very clear ethnic bias here in the only city that allowed for jury trials. In 1945, not being able to speak English was a ground for challenge in Lagos for jury selection. However, there's no challenges that have been made based on ethnic background in Nigeria, except hypothetically in instances where a member of a Yoruba tribe could kill an Igbo, then to ensure an impartial jury, an Igbo with bias against that Yoruba man could be struck from the jury. However, after all of this research, it showed that historically there was a racial bias of non-African men being on juries in Lagos, Nigeria, but there is no protection for preemptory challenges in Nigeria similar to the purpose of the U.S. Batson Challenge. Nigeria's ethnic and racial discrimination in the criminal justice system, particularly in the jury selection process, wasn't too different historically when compared to the history of the United States. Nigeria is home to hundreds of different African tribes, and many people of different ethnic background amongst their citizens. Unlike the United States, Nigeria did not have a protection against racially or ethnically driven strikes of a juror, like the U.S. has the Batson Challenge. But common ground was found today, in that the United States and Nigeria both decided that race and ethnicity were not grounds to challenge a juror. Thanks for tuning in to this week's episode, and we'll see you next week on Legal Systems for Dummies.